That's what he gives to the teachers in the study of man. That the child is pushing away everything that will remind it of, that will pull it back to its pre-earthly state, and developing a sympathetic relationship to everything that will pull it into the future, we might say. And this is what education is about, finding the right balance in every year between these sympathetic and antipathetic forces that are there. Now, what happens if these forces of antipathy are not strong enough towards the past, that we might say a child keeps feeling drawn to that world, that when things are difficult, that child will kind of scrunch up into themselves and even assume the fetal position. And you try to lift up like a 6 or 7 year old like that, and they weigh 1,000 pounds, it seems. We have autistic spectrum here. We might say the child who has not yet learned to talk, who has not yet learned to smile or to understand what it means for others to smile, whose limbs are foreign to him, they're still all over the place. Here we have, in a certain way, how do we work in a way cultivating forces of antipathy in such a child? What about sympathy? The child who's pulled to the future. Oh my God, what's that? Are we going to learn about that? When do we learn to do calculus? Wow, oh my God. What? Oh, sit down. Where do I sit? Forces of tremendous sympathy, we might say, that here the child is drawn to the future. And like the little force homunculus in Goethe's Faust Part II, which just lives quickly and perishes very, very quickly. There's this quality of moving double, triple, quadruple time. How do we then counterbalance these overly sympathetic forces and bring the child also into balance? This is what the curriculum is about. Here's another aspect of this curriculum, that Steiner had to talk to the teachers about two things. One, about the future. And let me try to quote what he had to say. The soul of the child and that of the teacher must be one, linked by special subconscious ties that proceed from the spirit of the teacher to that of the child. This is what will give the school its social structure. The relationship of the teacher to the child, above all. This will give the school its social structure. We're in the consciousness soul age. People who've chosen to be born into this age are going to be observers. They're going to be aloof. They're going to feel themselves separate from others, alienated. Members of the lonely crowd, we could say. So they have to be taught how to be social beings. And Steiner says it's the relationship with the teacher that does that. Schools today, private schools and certainly charter schools, have in them psychologists, social workers, who actually have positions in the school. They have experts coming in to work with social inclusion, to work with bullying, to work with teaching children how to accept diversity in the classroom, how to work with parents on simplicity parenting and so on. All of this is looked at as something extra that has to be added to the curriculum and often streams into the main lesson, and a teacher has 15 minutes to teach a main lesson because all these different committees are coming in asking the children if they were bullied today or if somebody violated their 18-inch personal space and things like that. So it's interesting. Steiner made things, in that regard anyway, much easier. He really said it's that relationship. But he takes this a little bit further. We do not need an education that is based on experimental psychology. That's what Steiner said. We don't need the school psychologist. We as teachers need an awakening of the living human nature that brings the whole child to life again through entering into a spiritual relationship with the child. We are, after all, dealing with what will live in the future, not in the present generation. In us has to live what only the following generations will bring to outer manifestation, something of a prophetic becoming one with the future development of humanity has to live in us. And he went still further and said, we must educate with prophetic foresight, that we must anticipate the tasks of the next generation is a serious matter. It is written into the world. Prophetic, that teachers must be prophets. Okay, so we have to think of the future, the future, the future. Then in the middle of all of the work he's doing, preparing for the school, he gave a lecture in Dornach to general members of the society, and he said, in our time, there certainly are people who believe in a spiritual world, but it's very one-sided. They believe in life after death, that after they die, they will go to heaven. And he said, complete egotism. You know, I'll be okay. Everybody else may go to hell, but I'll be fine. I'll be in heaven. And we see this in a way stronger than ever today. Said, our time, it's in absolutely important, essential for us to understand life before birth, that we must understand we live before we are born. That becomes as essential a matter. And this is absolutely sine qua non. Teachers must understand life before birth. That's where their attention should go. And then he's telling the teachers, you must think of the future, what's to come. Well, that means death eventually, right? So let's look at that in relationship to this picture. We could say the sympathetic forces come from the world after death, and all of those young men who died on the battlefield, who died of Spanish flu. This is, in a certain way, a world filled with sympathy. But he's saying we also have to look at the world pre-birth, unborn. And in fact, he had already explained something significant about this, that when we are born, we take part in a stream of time that takes us forward. So we're moving from the left part of this drawing, pre-birth, one step at a time, getting older year by year by year, until we finally cross the threshold of death. However, he said there is a second stream of time, and that moves from the future to the past. This is the stream of time that's moving here on my right side that I experience as pushing me in this direction, backwards. And it's one of the most beautiful things in a eurythmy class, maybe even our eurythmy teacher will attest to this, more than one here, to see children learning to walk backwards, to start to develop, we say, those eyes in the back of their head or eyes in their back, where they feel perfectly confident that their classmates will be moving in such a way that there's harmony. This is really an important experience for beginning to penetrate the world before birth. There's very, very little literature about this world. There are tremendous books about near-death experiences that are out now. And, you know, one can get some somewhat accurate writings about it, at least the very first step or two. Very little about the threshold of life before birth. We will find it in the writings of Tristan Treherne, a remarkable, still to some extent obscure English poet. He was a royalist at a time when the king was gone, so he had to hide his poetry. He basically disappeared his work for about 100 years, as initiates' work sometimes does, and then it was rediscovered. And he is the one who's written some very beautiful verses about that. William Wordsworth, who speaks about all heaven lying around us when we are born, he had a sense about this. William Blake, to some extent. And of all people, no relative of mine, the American poet and writer Delmore Schwartz, who wrote a remarkable book called In Dreams Begin Responsibilities, which begins in a movie theater. And it's a very profound, very powerful picture of the child's experience before birth. So, of course, if we're speaking about reincarnation, this is all a circle in a certain way, and we're really taking this progress repeatedly at different ways, and that this would mean that the Waldorf classroom would be a kind of nexus, a stopping point, a resting point in between incarnations. Okay, now think of this. Steiner says we live, let's say, the biblical 72 years or 80 years. Life's getting a little bit longer in the Western world. And then we stay in the spiritual world. The ideal picture would be 1,000 years, though undoubtedly that's being shortened. Okay, 75 into 1,000. I'm sorry to keep giving you these mathematical issues. Want to say about 1/12? Can we say that? It's about 12. We need 12 times as much time in the spiritual world to process our life on earth. That is how incredibly complicated and important every earthly life is. No time to waste. Okay, a child is with the class teacher for 8 grades, and then that child lives, let's say, to age 80 or maybe 90 today. 1/10, 1/11, almost 1/12. In those 8 grades, 7 was the ideal, and that would have been 1/12. In that period of time, we are getting the child ready for the rest of his or her life. What goes on here is of incredible importance. And remember, the original school did not have a kindergarten. It did not have a high school. That this was sort of what was Steiner was able to work out best and most fully, this picture of the curriculum. So what could we imagine concerning the incarnations of the children in the first Waldorf school, or even in a Waldorf school today, that perhaps 1919, they lived 1,000 years before, 900 years before. We're talking, of course, about the Middle Ages. Some children might not have been incarnated then. Many probably were. There's definitely a possibility here that in that classroom, there are some former monks and some former knights. And I think it was more than some in certain cases. So who was the knight? He rode on a horse. He was helpless if he wasn't on his horse because his mail armor or his solid armor was much too heavy to get around on the ground. He was constantly in a state of fighting or anticipating a fight with someone. He was battling at all times, and then sometimes having to withdraw and meet his own demons in a way, to go to where? A monastery. And there were the monks. They took vows, such as a vow of silence. Okay, now when they took a vow of silence, they probably did not say for this incarnation only. they took a vow of silence. And such vows, which were taken out of deep, heartfelt, and will-felt impulses, those went very, very deeply and very, very long into the human being. Okay, they take a vow also of not really participating in the astral life of human beings, of being celibate, of not having a strong emotional reaction to anything, of perhaps not even looking very long at their fellow monks. They're individuals whose attention is very much within, on their own transformation, their own development. The only sensory experience they might have of real significance is looking at the stained glass windows in their monastery or in a cathedral that they might have visited. The gardens, nature, okay, that's there as well, for sure. 1919 was the completion of a structure that we could say is really the last true medieval building in the world, built by the descendants of medieval stonemasons and glassworkers, built by the descendants of metalworkers, who brought skills that were 1,000 years old and constructed one of the most beautiful buildings in the United States, for sure. It's a short drive from here. You can go and see it. This is the Bryn Athyn Cathedral right outside of Philadelphia. It was completed in 1919, and its model, it was designed by a man who was not an architect, designed his own home in the same way, made a model, a kind of molded model first, and then built it up. And this is the home of the Swedenborgian Church in the community of Bryn Athyn. And one might say there's a quality when you go there that something, you can get a feeling for where you might have been in your last lifetime. It's the largest collection of medieval art in private hands in the world. Cloisters has borrowed some of its work. The Metropolitan Museum of Art has borrowed some of the work there. It's so priceless. Go and see it. So we have then this experience of the monk in the cathedral, in the monastery. Now the knights come back and they can't sit down for long. They want to be on their horses. They want to be going from place to place, flitting around, and above all, holding those swords, even if the swords are pencils or geometrical devices used for drawing a circle, a compass. They've got to have that in their hands, ready to use it at any time. And I'd say we have something here of the an imagination of, again, the ADHD child. That child rushing towards the threshold of death. And then we have the monks returning to our time, who want quiet, who can't take any degree of noise. It's painful for them, who can't relate emotionally, effectively to those around them, who want to live in a certain kind of contemplative self involved existence, and are always very close to returning to the spiritual world. Steiner spoke about Nietzsche, whom he had seen in the very last stage of his final illness, and he said he was able to see in Nietzsche an old monk who had practiced tremendous asceticism, who had driven his higher members out of his body in a previous incarnation, and even in this incarnation, they struggled to find their way into that physical body. And this accounted for Nietzsche's endless struggle and battle with himself and battle with others, and finally, his premature, it would seem, excarnation. So here we have, in a way, a state of a kind of autism that overtook Nietzsche at the end of his life. Monks and knights, how can we work with that in the Waldorf setting? Well, don't we have a monastery in the Waldorf school? We work in the scriptorium on the books. We go out into the garden and learn how to take care, how to tend the plants. We sing together. We pray before we start the day. We pray before we eat. We may have a prayer or a verse at the end of the day. Everything is wonderfully laid out according to Vespers, as it were. The ringing of the bell, the teacher as the abbot, the teacher as the mother superior, leading the children in a way